Welcome to the No More, Risk Better, a Credit Sites podcast. I'm Winnie Caesar, the Global Head of Strategy.
And I'm Zach Griffiths, the Credit Sites Senior Investment Grade Strategist.
As strategists, we aim to make sense of the macro and the micro, highlighting opportunities and the risks facing the fixed income markets.
As important as the macro call may be, we understand that credit investing, at its core, comes down to keen single name selection, and we at Credit Sites benefit from the expertise of our team of over 100 analysts across the US, Europe, and Asia.
This podcast offers a look at the conversations that we have with our analysts on a regular basis. If you are an investment professional focused on the wide universe of fixed income, you'll want to give this podcast a listen.
Hello, and thank you for tuning in to No More, Risk Better, a Credit Sites podcast. I'm your host, Zach Griffiths, and today we have a very special guest. Michael Brown is joining us. He is the principal U.S. economist at Visa, where he's responsible for overseeing Visa's analysis and forecasting of the U.S. economy. Prior to joining Visa, Michael was an economist at Wells Fargo for 8 years, and prior to that, he was an economist and legislative analyst for the Arkansas General Assembly for 3 years. Before that, I had the pleasure of working with Michael back at Wells Fargo when I started out my career in economics, so I'm very excited to catch up with him. Michael, thanks so much for coming on the podcast.
Thanks a lot, Zach. Great to be back with you.
All right. And so jumping right in, we really appreciate you being here. And I had a chance to read your latest note, understand you're looking for the U.S. economy to expand at a 2.6% year-over-year pace this year before downshifting a little bit next year with the first Fed rate cut coming at the June meeting. So last time you and I caught up informally, I think it was around the middle of last year, I think you still had a modest recession in your outlook. So before we dive into a few more consumer-focused topics, can you just take me through what has changed over the past 6 to 9 months in terms of what you're seeing in the economy going forward?
Sure. I think, you know, we often get hung up on this concept of a recession. And I'll be candid, we step back to our outlook, let's say 6 months ago. You know, the storyline that was unfolding is historically when the Fed tightens at this rate and to this magnitude, we tend to see a subsequent slowing in GDP growth. And that did not happen this time. We would have expected the labor market to start downshifting a little bit, at least in terms of the pace of job growth, not necessarily losses. That didn't happen. And then, you know, sort of the third leg of the stool, if you will, is consumer spending has just been growing gangbusters. Now, granted, we had a couple of soft spots at the end of last year for a month or two. But by and large, consumer spending, at least in the aggregate, is holding up very nicely. And, you know, we're just now, here we are in Q1 of 2024, after months of rate hikes, just now starting to see some signs of maybe softening, but I wouldn't call it weakness by any stretch.
Yeah, it's been incredible to see just how strong the consumer has been. That's something that came up in our meetings with sector analysts coming into this year. We had thought it was probably time to get a little bit more bearish, and even they were like, we're seeing a normalization in some trends, but really nothing that would be consistent with a recession. So that resonates with us. And in your latest note, you referred to the Visa Spending Momentum Index. And I'm really interested to hear a little bit more about this. I think you alluded to it in a prior conversation we had, but kind of take us through what goes into that measure and really how you use it to help inform your economic forecasts.
Well, this is the power of our VisaNet network. We look at roughly $8.8 trillion in total payment volume. So that's the volume that runs across our rails globally in the course of a year. You boil that down, that gets you about north of 65,000 transactions per second occurring on our network. And so what we're able to do, and the power of being an economist here at Visa, is being able to leverage some of that data. Now, of course, we're doing that in a responsible way. It's aggregated level data. Everything is anonymized and depersonalized. But what we do is we look at spend relative to the same point a year ago, and we kind of give it a score. If you sort of spent more, we score you a 200. If you spent about the same as you did last year, it's about a 100, and below that, a zero if you spent less. And we do this for tens of millions of cardholders throughout our network. And when you aggregate all that data up, we come up with this diffusion index concept. The way I like to describe it to folks is we know in February, retail sales grew 1.5% on a year-on-year basis. What our metric says is, how broad-based is the support behind that 1.5% year-on-year growth? So think of it this way. If there are only five consumers supporting that year-on-year growth, that's a pretty vulnerable number, that 1.5%. And there's a good chance we could see deceleration in subsequent months. However, if we've got 105 million people supporting that in a broad-based, inclusive manner, then we have a lot more resiliency behind that measure. And there's probably some upside risk in subsequent months. So that's really what we're trying to do, is get just a layer deeper instead of just looking at the raw growth, but we're looking at how inclusive is that spending growth across a number of dimensions.
And so what are the latest data telling you in terms of, is that a broadly supported, or does it seem like more of a sensitive reading in the sense that it's being driven by just a few consumers, maybe in certain cohorts of the economy?
Yeah, so our latest measure is 94.7 to be exact. But what does that mean? Well, it's below 100, right? So there's less broad-based support than we had a year ago behind consumer spending growth. Now, there's some quirkiness to the data. Everybody was talking about weather effects impacting consumer spending in the first, in January of this year. That was absolutely true. We're able to look at this data down to the metro level. And so we could see those metro levels that were impacted by the winter storms in January. We had two of them, Finn and Jerry, if you recall, these winter storms impacting various regions of the country, even as far south as Texas and other parts of the plain states. We could see that about a week after the month ended, we were able to see the weather impacts. So February, we bounced back. We didn't get above 100, but we did get a little bit of momentum. And what's interesting is the largest source of the bounce back was actually in discretionary spending items. If you think about what happens around these weather events, everybody runs out to the grocery store and sort of stocks up. So our non-discretionary, that grocery and these sorts of items, start surging. And that's what happened in January. And that kind of reversed a little bit. But the discretionary piece came back a little bit. So that's your travel. Of course, we have a restaurant index as well, and we saw a bounce back in that measure. So, you know, we're not as well off as we were in terms of that inclusiveness and growth last year, relative to last year, but things are certainly improving.
And so just to frame up where we are today relative to what we saw a year ago, when the consumer and economic growth broadly really surprised to the upside in a very meaningful way, where did that index peak out at recently when, you know, look back over the past 12 to 18 months, whatever the appropriate time frame is to look back?
Well, this is the interesting part of this whole story, and that is this measure has actually been below 100 for almost a year now. And so while we haven't seen broader measures, nominal consumer spending, retail sales, showing the effects of interest rate hikes, we absolutely have seen it in our spending momentum index data. So there are absolutely parts of demographics that are being impacted by higher interest rates. And you're seeing that in the form of less broad-based support for consumer spending growth this year relative to last year. And frankly, if you go back and look at our recession call, one of the key factors that was underlying that assumption was not some, you know, probability model. It was our data saying, look, the support for consumption growth is slowing, it's eroding. And that gave us, it sent up alarm bells, and frankly, the reason why we had sort of the soft GDP growth numbers that we did.
So when you're thinking about where we are today, how long this underlying spending momentum index has been below that 100 threshold, obviously you don't have a recession as the base case right now, but do you think that slowing growth, are the risks skewed to the downside perhaps relative to your base case forecast? I know I mentioned at the outset that you have growth at 2.6% this year, I think 2025 down to 2.3%. So seeing it in those projected forecast numbers, but when you're thinking about the balance of risks, how does this feed into it?
So, you know, I think the risks are definitely skewed to the downside, but I'd say only slightly. And here's the reason I say that. When you think about sort of the contours of growth this year, the big question is, can we get to the first interest rate cut without too much damage, so to speak, on the consumer side of the economy and the business side of the economy? And it's really a horse race at this point. Companies were sitting on a lot of cash. Consumers were sitting on a lot of cash, and that prevented, if you will, or at least delayed the impact of higher interest rates impacting durable goods purchases, major business investment decisions. Now, that story has sort of run its course. And as a result, you're in this situation where we're trying to see if the Fed's got to trim rates before sort of the economy slows down. And frankly, I think we're right on a knife edge of not necessarily a recession, but do we downshift significantly in terms of the macro growth that we've been seeing? And then, after that rate cut begins, I think we start seeing a little bit of normalization.
That sounds very similar to the conversations we've had internally. It's like some of this buffer, maybe all of this buffer that we've had from the fiscal stimulus that we had following COVID seems to have finally worked its way through the system. You've had a very delayed impact of much tighter monetary policy in nominal terms and more recently in real terms. And so what does that mean going forward? I think everyone is grappling with that. Of course, we have the Fed this week on Wednesday. We're recording this on March 18th. Real quick, kind of as an aside, are you expecting, obviously you're not looking for a rate cut. Are you keeping an eye on anything in particular in terms of an indication of any changes with respect to forward guidance or where you think policy is headed?
Yes. I mean, as you know, Zach, we get a statement of economic projections. And if there's ever a kid in the candy store moment for an economist, it's those SEPs that we get from the Fed. And, honestly, when you think about sort of the major risk right now that the Fed is staring at, it's how sticky are inflation pressure. And how persistent will that be? And I don't think anybody has the answer to that. If you deconstruct sort of the drivers of inflation, and you probably know this better than others, it's really goods prices that have come down. We haven't seen much movement on the services side. And if I'm sitting here at the Fed looking at this incoming inflation data, I'm really concerned how transitory, here we go with that word again, but how transitory the prices are that are coming down for these goods. And I think what we're seeing in the PPI data last week, the CPI data last week, all of that suggested that maybe, just maybe, there was just a transitory piece of this goods inflation coming down. So I'm really going to be keyed in on what Chairman Powell is saying about the committee's interpretation of current inflation dynamics, and more importantly, the statement of economic projections. I mean, we've been a little out of consensus with respect to Fed rate cuts. We had, about five cuts that we were anticipating this year. I'm seeing a number of folks, other forecast shops, dial that back. And so we will be reevaluating after the press conference this week whether or not we want to maintain that. And again, it's all grounded in how quickly these inflation pressures are going to start easing on us.
Yeah, that's something that we're taking a very close look at, obviously. And so our base case is for four cuts this year. We've held that view for a while. It's interesting. We thought at one point they could begin cutting as soon as March, but I'd say the inflation data, as you highlighted, to start the year have not given them that greater confidence that they're looking for to move just yet. But we still think that that's possible shortly down the road here. So shifting gears, Michael, I mean, you have such a great view into the U.S. consumer with your perspective from Visa. One of the things I want to get your perspective on is, are you seeing any lingering behavioral shifts from the COVID era? And more importantly, are you expecting any of those lingering behavioral shifts to become permanent or, let's say, at least very long term in nature?
So there's a couple. One is macro and the other is a little more micro to our business. So on the macro front, we were just talking about the stickiness or maybe the transitory nature of those goods prices coming down. One of the reasons that the Fed is still concerned about that is the fact that when you look at a split of the way we as consumers spent leading up to 2019, was disproportionately skewed towards services with a little bit of penetration on goods, but it was really skewed towards services. Of course, during COVID, that disrupted. We weren't dining out. That switched. We were ordering everything online and having it delivered at home. And then post-COVID, yes, we started to get a little more equilibrium, but the penetration rate of how you and I are spending on goods relative to services is still higher than it was pre-COVID. And that's a behavior that has pretty much stuck. And here we are, what, 3.5 years later, post-lockdowns, and that behavior is still there. So this is the macro story that I think could be the reason why we're seeing such sticky inflation, is this rebalance has not fully occurred yet. Now, on the micro front, it's kind of interesting. There's the macro trend of greater e-commerce usage. We've kind of leveled out in terms of the e-commerce penetration. So one of the things we learned is consumers still like to shop in the store. And that lends itself to kind of our micro story, which is they don't want to have to sort of touch those dirty terminals. They want to be able to use tap to pay and quickly get through the checkout process. So that's a micro trend that we were just blown away at the adoption of this tap to pay contactless technology that is everywhere from the subway turnstiles in New York to your local pharmacy. And so we were just really, really surprised at how quickly the adoption rate was here. You know, when we look at other countries in Europe, when we rolled that technology out initially, it was very impressive how quickly Americans adopted that new form of payment and quickly.
Interesting. So just to sum that up, from a macro perspective, we aren't seeing the shift back toward less spending on goods that was typical or a characteristic of the expansion up until 2019. And from a micro perspective, consumers still like to go to the shop, but they want to be able to use the tap to pay and make that as simple as possible, maybe not as interactive with as many people, or the kind of the lingering effect of COVID, of maybe some of these back of the head concerns of trying to limit exposure to others. So I think that's really interesting. And I hadn't heard that perspective, because one of the things that we sort of have underlying our base case projection for inflation to continue moving down is more of a return to that 2010 to 2019 spending on goods, which was lower. And we had core goods deflation regularly throughout that period. And so when you think about those takeaways, how does that shape your inflation forecast? Are you really concerned about goods kind of staying buoyant? And if that is the case, just kind of looking at the recent breakout, that would be a big driver of the headline, certainly going forward.
Yeah, so we do have inflation gradually getting to the Fed's 2% target by the end of this year. It's a fourth quarter type story. And I think the dynamics that are underlying our inflation outlook are less goods centric and more focused on the labor market dynamics of how robust will wage growth be in the coming quarters. And so Yes, the second and third quarters of this year, we have softer macro growth, which of course reduces the aggregate demand and the need for as many hours worked. I'm not saying we're going to see layoffs. As a matter of fact, we don't expect that given the tightness of the labor market, but we do expect hours worked to continue to fall. And in the aggregate, that will be enough to kind of slow some of these wage pressures that have made the Fed, frankly, uncomfortable in terms of this dynamic. The good news here, and I think this is the piece that, frankly, we missed coming into this year, is we have seen a pretty pronounced snapback in immigration, and particularly immigration among prime working age individuals. And that's roughly age 25 to 54. And when you look at this dynamic, and you can see this in some of the underlying details between in the unemployment rate, but the dynamic here is that when you look at the foreign-born share of workers versus the domestic workers, that has really jumped higher in the last few months. And we think that this additional labor supply is helping to bring wages or wage pressure down just slightly enough to maybe bring the labor market closer to equilibrium. I'm not going to say we're not getting rid of the labor market tightness overnight, but it's certainly helping the Fed with this dynamic. And we think that that's really what helps us get closer to 2%. The goods prices are going to do what they do. Food and energy are still going to be the wild cards, given the conflicts that we have abroad, of course.
That's great perspective, and not something that we've heard a ton about either. And so just to round that all out, what is your expectation in terms of the unemployment rate? It sounds like maybe a very modest drift higher, if anything at all.
Yeah, we have the unemployment rate peaking right around 4.2% in the third quarter of this year. So yes, very mild. You do get a little bit of the pullback in hours worked. There may be certain sectors that are cyclical in nature, leisure and hospitality, retail, that we'll see an outright pullback in jobs. But in the aggregate, we're not expecting major job losses. And so as a result, you know, we do expect with that labor supply growth, a little bit of an uptick in the unemployment rate.
Great. So just digging into some of these credit card specific, consumer specific indicators that we've seen, some measures of the delinquency rate on credit cards are up toward the highest they've been since 2011. So in terms of what you're seeing there, and I think some of these other indicators, if you don't scale them properly by the size of the economy or looking at some of the more important underlying details like the revolving credit, I think that hit $13 trillion and that got a lot of headline. When you think about the delinquency rate that we're seeing and putting these things more holistically, how do you feel about the state of the consumer broadly from your seat, which I think has about as good of insight there as any?
Well, as I said, not everybody is experiencing the same sort of economy. And I think this is particularly acute for those in, say, the bottom 40% of income earning households. And when you look at the data, the first thing we know is that their shopping basket, their typical shopping basket, skews towards food and energy. And that's where we've seen the most acute inflation over the last year, year and a half or so. You stack on top of that, yes, they've had some strong wage growth, but at the same time, that real purchasing power, that inflation-adjusted purchasing power has not been there. So you're absolutely seeing those middle and lower income households struggle a little bit. You know, another dynamic that was introduced is some of these folks have student loan payments that resumed last fall. And, you know, that's spending that on those payments that they can't use elsewhere. So there's a lot of dynamics that are kind of churning under the surface. In the aggregate, yeah, the consumer health is pretty good. You look at things like the financial obligations ratio or the household debt service ratio, those are actually at fairly low levels historically and certainly relative to the last expansion. But when you look under the surface, there are certain pockets that we do absolutely see risk, but you know we're not seeing it in a broad-based manner.
All right, so there's some risk out there, but it seems manageable at this point. Have you found any of the credit card spending data, whether it be looking at the spending momentum index, to have a very strong relationship with inflation? Or is that, you know, when thinking about can you use that as either a sign of a further disinflation ahead or more inflation ahead, have you found that to be particularly useful, or is there more that needs to go into that?
The short answer is there's a little more work that needs to go into that, right? So we do filter, you know, through our process, and you know, not every card in our network is actually captured in that spending momentum index because we need to have seen spend persistently for the last 12 months in order to gauge whether or not that spend increased, decreased, or stayed the same. And so we're controlling plus or minus roughly about 4 to 5%. If inflation on a year-on-year basis exceeds that, then we get closer to, you know, seeing some of those inflation effects kick up our measure. One of the challenges that we have with our gas subcomponent is that it is very sensitive to fuel prices, as you can imagine. And so it's hard for us to disentangle real versus kind of the nominal growth, if you will, in the card data. It is difficult enough to take transactions data and get a macro signal that makes any sense at all. We have seasonal adjustment and leap years and all these fun things that we have to think through, but it gets really challenging with inflation. So we tend to look at our business in a nominal basis, not a real basis, but as an economist, it is frustrating sometimes. We would like to see that inflation adjustment.
Yes, I can definitely relate to those challenges. And so there's, you know, one other hot topic out there that seems to come and go from the financial press narrative. It's this lingering potential risk from buy now, pay later trends. And I've seen internally, we've done some work just trying to quantify it. And depending on which measure you think most accurately captures that part of the market, it's still very small. But do you have any particular insight into that? Is that something that you have data on that is perhaps better than what we can get from some of the regular sources we have? And if so, is there anything to you that suggests that's perhaps a risk that needs to garner more attention these days?
So the short answer is we don't know. And I think, you know, as you describe, it's very challenging to unpack. It's a new area for growth. Not all of that is occurring in sort of the traditional banking sector. And so that creates some challenges for measurement as well. I think, you know, if you talk to the credit bureaus, they're trying to figure out how do you accurately capture it, measure it, and understand the risk. So the short answer, unfortunately, it's one of those trends that is too new for us to really quantify.
All right, Michael, is there anything that we haven't gone through that's really top of mind for you when you're discussing with your team and updating your outlooks that you think we should keep our eye on from an economic perspective before we let you go here?
Well, you know, I think just broadly speaking, I think, you know, we know that the consumer sort of tugs and pulls the most on macro growth. And so we are laser focused on that piece of the economy, obviously. A couple of things that we're going to be keeping an eye on is consumer confidence. I mean, we have an election year. We tend to see a little bit of an impact depending on political parties and these sorts of things on some of this consumer sentiment indices. So the tea leaves of consumer is going to get a little tricky as the year progresses. And I would say, you know, let's focus more on the real measures of, you know, real consumer spending. Of course, my bias, the Spending Momentum Index, and some of these other alternative tools to cut through some of that noise. And I think we'll be just fine as the year progresses.
Yeah, plenty of noise to come with the election. We'll all be grappling with that for the next 7 or 8 months. So that'll be interesting. But Michael, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. I found this extremely insightful and interesting, and I'm sure all of our listeners did as well. So that's Michael Brown, Principal U.S. Economist at Visa. Thanks again, Michael.
Thank you, Zach.
And thank you all for tuning in. We will catch you next time on No More Risk Better.
Credit Sites disclaimer. All price references correspond to the date of this recording. This podcast should not be copied, distributed, or reproduced in whole or in part. Neither Credit Sites nor its affiliates makes any representation or warranty as to the accuracy or completeness of any information contained in this podcast. Credit Sites is not providing investment, legal, accounting, or tax advice, is not providing research or making any recommendations, nor is Credit Sites offering or soliciting any transaction with respect to the purchase or sale of any security. The receipt by this listener of this podcast is not the giving of advice by Credit Sites or its affiliates. Yes.